Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of one's possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God."
Well, thanks, Erin, and good evening, everyone. May I add my own welcome, and it's super to have you with us this evening. So our topic is life is busy, and here in London, don't we know that? Life is crazy busy. Maybe you just come from Bank Station at rush hour. Try Oxford Street on Saturday. Wherever you go, people busy, so much going on. And then life is busy too with it. Obviously, there's work. And then with that, there's people to see. There are things to do, experiences to have. Maybe you wanted to catch up with that friend, so you do diaries, and you're very pleased to find that first free evening in 2 months' time. Can I say I'm very glad you found the time to join us tonight, given I know how busy you must be. But in all this busyness, our question is assuming that, well, religion just gets squeezed out. Now, some, of course, are openly hostile to religion, but for others, it's not really that. It's more that, well, maybe this is you. You're not particularly against it so much. In fact, maybe you'll join your family for that religious festival. You may well squeeze a carol service in at Christmas, and you're fine with that. That's all okay. But just the rest of the time, well, too busy. And so, as our title asks, in response to life as we find it here in London, what would Jesus say? Well, we've just heard Jesus tell a parable, which is a story, and you heard it was about a very busy man. He was a farmer, successful, rich, maybe in London terms, we don't have any farmers, he'd be the commodities trader. And he's got a problem maybe we would all quite like to have, which is that he's doing very well. But doing well causes its own problems. The land is producing plentifully, more crops than actually he knows what to do with. So we find he asks himself, "What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops." And we see his reasoning, and then he concludes, if you like, he bites the bullet. Yes, it's going to be a real hassle. There's nothing else for it. He's going to have to embark on a building project. Barns. Out with the old barns, in with the new. And obviously, this means he's going to be busy for a stretch. He'll have to get his head down. It'll be stressful, contractors to deal with. But of course, it would be worth it. Because then he would have plenty of space for all the grain. And notice what it also says, for all the possessions that will go with it. So if you like, he can see what's going to happen. Retirement is beckoning. Maybe still in his mid-40s, at which point he could then live the dream. Kick back, feet up, relax, eat, drink, and be merry. So if you'd have asked him in all this, what about religion for you? My hunch is he might say nothing against it. In fact, he says, I'm hoping to get a bit more involved when I've got more time for it. But at the moment, too busy. Now, Jesus told this story many years ago in a far-off corner of the world. But yet, remarkably, it does seem to sum up for us 21st century London life. Life is busy. And it also shows us why, really, life does get so busy for so many people. Because we are working for the future. Maybe the dream towards which might be quite simply a secure, stable future. And therefore, we need to be busy now. Now, there's a whole range of us here tonight in different situations. We may have a student or two. And of course, for you, studying is the first step onto the first rung of that career ladder. There'll be others maybe on the grad scheme, getting the experience, making the contacts to get on in life. Others will be mid-career at some point, but maybe you're hoping the role you've got now in London will be just the thing for the CV for the next step, wherever that might be. Well, whatever it is, or whatever stage we are, the logic is that we're working for the long term. We want to set ourselves up. Money will be a big part of that, so that one day, well, we'll be able to enjoy the finer things of life, us and our families. Maybe a home to call our own, maybe even a second home, somewhere nice. Together with the travel, the experiences, the finest restaurants, maybe the cruise, all the rest. One day, that's where we're heading. So we look at this man and maybe we admire him, maybe even did you envy him? I guess in today's terms, he would be the annoying early investor in Bitcoin. Maybe he's the one that just seems to get those lucky breaks at work, meets the right clients who then give a huge amount of money his way. Notice there's no hint of corruption in this man. He's doing it fair and square, hard work. And then with that now, you can see he's securing his position and improving it step by step. His future is looking good. I mean, he's the guy they'll invite onto the TED Talks to tell the rest of us how it's to be done. But look down to verse 20. But God said to him, "Fool, you idiot, you've got it all wrong." And I hope that stops us in our tracks, at least a little bit. That's what it's meant to do. Because, well, it's a little unsettling, isn't it? Because we look at that man and think, well, I wish I was like him. We think he's got it made. We find even now, really, our attitudes and actions are remarkably similar to his, as the typical aspirational Londoner trying to get ahead. Why then would God call him a fool? Well, that's the question, that's the issue. And we'll see now, Jesus wants us to realize three things about this man, what he got so wrong. We'll look at each in turn briefly. The first is this: his planning was short-sighted. His planning was short-sighted. Let's read on in verse 20. God said to him, "Fool, this night your soul is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be?" Now, at school, a friend of mine, Kevin, was a ridiculously high achiever. He was popular as well, so very annoying, really. But he went from school, we left at the same time, he went to Cambridge, where he got a rowing blue in the boat race. He got two, actually, in fact, of course. He left university and joined the Royal Air Force, where he was a fast jet pilot. Think Top Gun, that was Kevin. When that came to an end, after a few years' service, he then came to the city, and sure enough, he became a trader, joined a bank, did very well. He married a beautiful lady. They had a young daughter, another one on the way. He was 39 when he suddenly dropped dead. And you see, this man in our story is living out his life, building his barns, with the assumption that he will live out his years, that he'll have the time to enjoy the fruit of his efforts. And the first challenge, I guess, is, are we doing the same, I wonder? That is, does our life now, however busy it is, actually only make sense if, well, assuming two things. One, that our business will pay off and we will get ahead. But also, two, that we too will be given the years to enjoy the fruit of our labor. People keep telling us, plan for the long term. But what if there is no long term for us? But having said that, maybe our business will pay off. Maybe we will be around long enough to enjoy it. But still, it doesn't actually change the fact that the time will come, to use Jesus' language, that our soul is required of us. And Jesus is asking the question, what then? And here is why the rich man's planning was so short-sighted. it wasn't actually that he would die early, although that happening, if you like, sharpens the issue for us. In fact, he hadn't planned at all for beyond death, whenever that would come. And it's at this point Londoners will roll their eyeballs and say, here we go. Religion. This is the problem. Because here are these unsubstantiated assumptions about some afterlife leading quickly into a guilt trip to make people do whatever this religion wants us to do. Surely, we think, we've grown beyond that. Progress, science, evidence, reason. This life is all there is. You just have to make the most of it while you can. The comedian Eddie Izzard recently summed it up like this. He said, I have a very strong sense that we are only on this planet for a short length of time. Religious people might think it goes on after death. My feeling is that if that is the case, it would be nice if just one person came back and let us know. But what if that has already happened? What if one person in history died and was buried and then physically rose again to new life, then appeared before hundreds of witnesses, so there is plenty of evidence to prove it? Well, if that is the case, then surely the reasonable course of action would be to listen to that man. And therefore, it would be short-sighted in the extreme to plan our lives as if this life is all that there is. So Jesus says, don't be short-sighted in your planning. Second, the thing that Jesus wants us to know about this man as we look at him, he wasn't rich enough. Here's the question, how much money do you need? You must have thought of that. How much will be enough? John D. Rockefeller, the American industrialist and philanthropist, maybe the richest individual in modern history, was once asked, how much money is enough? To which he famously replied, just a little bit more. Money makes the world go round, and London is at the heart of that. But in the midst of all this busyness, we don't really stop to think. We haven't got a moment to wonder, will amassing these riches, however much that is for us, even actually deliver on what we and everyone just assumes that they will? And Jesus wants to force that issue into our minds by asking, as he does here in verse 20, the things you have prepared, whose will they be? That is, when this man here dies, well, what of his barns, his goods, his grain? Whose will they be? Notice we're not told whether the man has a family, whether he ever got round in his busyness to making a will. Because that's not what Jesus is getting at here at all. Whose will these things be? And the answer, quite simply, is not his. That's the point. You might have seen about that reclusive billionaire who died, much interest in discovering the extent of his wealth, which he'd managed to keep a closely guarded secret. How much did he leave? You know the answer. Everything. And it will be exactly the same for each of us. And that's what leads to Jesus' question in verse 21. Do look down with me. Where Jesus says, so is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. You see, on his death, we've called this man all the way through the rich man. It turns out he was left with nothing because he now had no assets of his own to call on. Nothing at all when it really mattered. Here, if you like, is the final reckoning, the final totting up, the final accounts. And he's poor. He wasn't rich enough. He didn't have what mattered, which Jesus describes as riches towards God. So here's two problems we've seen so far. His planning was short-sighted. He wasn't rich enough. Then third, Jesus says, look at this man. He took bad advice. He took bad advice. Here we are in the square mile. As you know, people and firms will pay good money for good advice. So who do we think was advising this supposedly rich man? Well, look again at verse 19, where he says, and I will say to my soul, soul, Do you realize what's going on there? The man is talking to himself. If you like, he took the wrong advice because his advisor was himself. And we find here in London, don't we, everyone or lots of people are far too busy for religion. And yet we find we still have our spiritual views. For example, people have decided that life is only what they see now. That's a spiritual conclusion that they've come to. Plenty of others, they might have decided for themselves what it is that will bring peace or spirituality or fulfillment. They might even say, well, I like to think of God as whatever it is. To which the question is, how do you know all of this? Where does it come from? And if you were to follow that up maybe by saying, well, who told you? They might say, oh, no, but I just realized it. I worked it out for myself. Just like the rich man. He worked it out. He decided. He advised himself. And so people do today. And why does that matter? Well, if you look carefully at the way Jesus told the story, the way the man takes advice actually reflects his whole way of life. Let me read again from verse 17, which I will overemphasize then to make the point. You'll see what I mean. So look down to verse 17. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops." And he said, "I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry.'" I'm sure you could hear it as I read it then. Maybe we didn't even notice the first time, because we are so used to it. This is how we still speak today. I'll do this, I'll do that. It's mine to do with as I wish. But notice for the man, it really is all about me. No mention of, well, God at all. In fact, he's living clearly, isn't he, as if there is no God. But you could ask, well, but what's the problem? What's wrong with that? The issue is it doesn't reflect the reality of his situation. How so? Well, think, this rich man had this land, which is how Jesus' story begins. But where did that come from? If you like, who put the land there? Who created it? Who ultimately owns that land? And then this land produced plentifully, but why did it produce plentifully? Was it really all due to the man? Who caused the rain to fall, the sun to shine? And then the man himself, we'd have looked up to him, we'd have thought, he's sharp, he knows what he's doing. But where did that sharp business acumen come from? Why is he able to think so reasonably? And then we discover, we just heard him talking to himself, that breath he used. Where did that come from? The man's whole life showed he had no time for a creator. He wasn't interested. There's no scrap of gratitude for all these things. He, in fact, thought he knew better. It was all down to him. His life was for him to live as he pleased. Fool. Now, don't misunderstand foolishness. Foolishness in the Bible is not about low IQ. There are highly intelligent, competent fools. What Jesus is talking about is not IQ, it's the issue of the way we treat our Creator, the way we respond to the reality of the situation in which we find ourselves. And then the story reminds us, the same Lord God who gives then takes it away. And that's when this man dies, isn't he? He meets his Maker, and he has nothing. He has no relationship with God, as we have seen, in the way that he lives on earth. All his life, that man wanted God to stay out of the picture and to leave him alone. And ultimately, that is exactly what God will give him. He will leave him to it. But every good gift that we have comes from God, and so then there'll be nothing for this man to eat, to drink, to be merry with. Quite the opposite. Think of the obituary in the newspaper for this man. It would have said he died a rich man. But actually, he was penniless. In fact, it was worse than that. He had run up this enormous debt, taking all this from God, but without a moment's thought in return. Here is a debt that he could never repay. And as we read this, Jesus wants us to realize that our situation is just the same. We've actually all treated our Maker like this rich man did. We grabbed the gifts, sure, we chased after them, we were busy to get them, and in all that, we ignored the giver. So if you like, you and I likewise are not rich in what really counts towards God. We too have this debt we cannot repay. So what now? Well, the question is, whose advice will you listen to? Will you carry on with the bad advice? And the bad advice is listening to myself, listening to ourselves, deciding for ourselves what's right, what's wrong. Well, we've seen that leads to disaster because we don't know best. Or, again, we could listen to the one who knows, our Creator, one who's come back from the dead. We could listen to Jesus. And if we do, we'll find he won't tell us, here are five steps to get rich with God. He'll actually tell us, no, you actually can't do it at all. Don't you realize your debt is far too big for you ever to pay off? But if we keep listening, we realize Jesus is actually much more than an advisor. He'll tell us, it's this we read on in Luke's gospel, that our debt is too big to pay for, but he will pay it instead, which he did by going to his death on the cross. Because of that, the riches we really need, the riches towards God, Jesus says, I'll give them to you freely if you come to me for them. The life that we were made to enjoy now and forever can be ours. So London says, I'm too busy for religion, by which it really means I'm too busy for God, I'm too busy for my Creator who gives me life and breath and everything else. What would Jesus say? Don't be a fool. Which means learn from this man. His planning, remember, was short-sighted. He wasn't rich enough. He'd only ever listened to his own advice. Instead, listen to Jesus. Hear what he can do. How he can make us truly rich, even beyond death. Well, thanks for listening. I'll hand back over to Philip.
Well, in about 5 minutes, we're going to put your questions to Aaron. You might like to grab one of those question slips if you haven't done already and just write down a question. And as you're doing so, whilst you're writing, you might want to refill your glasses from one of the two tables. And somebody will be around your table in a little while in order to collect your questions, and then we will put them to Aaron in 5 minutes' time. Well, if I could break into your conversations once again. And Aaron, why don't you come and join us? Well, we're going to try and answer your questions. We'll do our best. And apologies already if we don't answer your specific question. What we're going to try and do is to answer a representative sample of your questions. In some cases, you've asked it in a very similar way or even asked exactly the same question. So we'll do our best. And please don't feel that this is your last opportunity. Please do feel free to ask and more questions about this and talk around your tables if you don't feel you've had an answer. Well, here's our first question. Somebody asks, why should I listen? How do I know if the Bible is real and of authority?
That is a great question because that is the fundamental basic question. Why should I pay attention? The third point I said, he listened to bad advice. Is this really good advice? Should I take it seriously? Why don't we turn to the first page of Luke's Gospel and see what Luke... So this is, you'd find this in any Bible. It's what you'd find there, Gospel according to St. Luke. But what is it? Why should I therefore take it seriously? I'll begin reading. Luke says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught." Did you notice that first line? Once upon a time in a land far, far away. Except that's not what it says, is it? It's not the fairy tale that a lot of people seem to think the Bible is, all made up, spirituality, someone's views. No, Luke says he was aware that lots had happened in his day. We're talking the first century. Lots of people had been writing about the things that had been accomplished. So these are events in history. And clearly lots of chat about them, so Luke says, I'm going to write them down. So he was a historian, he was actually a doctor, and so he found out what had happened. He was an eyewitness to the events soon after Jesus' resurrection, but before that he had to ask around in the time when many would have seen them, and he says, I've gathered them together, put them in order so that you can be sure. And notice to Theophilus. Now Theophilus was one of these people, it seems, who'd heard about what had happened, all about Jesus. But Luke says, I don't want you to just take, well, other people's word for it, just because that's what people seem to be saying, old wives' tales. He says, no, I want you to be certain, verse 4. So notice the Bible is serious about evidence and fact so that you can be sure. So this is a historical document, and we have every reason to believe it was written in the first century, and this is an accurate record of it. So my first response would be, if you want to know, is this authoritative, can I take it seriously, is you have to read it. Does it, for a start, read like it could be what it claims to be? And if it is, then you need to reckon with it, because it's authoritative in that it speaks of what truly happened and what Jesus said.
Thank you, Aaron. Here's a very honest question. It feels that the good people die young, and yet the bad seem to live until their 90s. What do we say?
Yeah, that's a fair question. That is often true. I mentioned my friend from school, 39. I think he was a great guy. Happens all too much. The Bible recognises it. Why do the wicked prosper is the language the Bible would use for that. Others die young. Jesus died when he was early 30s. So the Bible does know of this. The answer to that is our world has gone seriously wrong. And the Bible knows the horror of it. And things like that really shake us up when we realise this world really is broken. It's not just a little bit bad, but if I play my cards right, I can navigate my way through. It's fundamentally warped. There's something wrong with it. And it's actually answering that question that is key to realising the state we are in. The Bible simply says the world's as it is because of the way we've treated our Creator. I mean, sin is the Bible word, but it means we've ignored him, we're not interested, like that rich man. And because of that, the world really is broken. And that's a wake-up call, isn't it? And whoever wrote that question may well be heartfelt, and it could well be. But that's right. I mean, C.S. Lewis, a famous Christian writer, Oxford Don, Cambridge professor, you know, said that suffering is a megaphone to wake us up. So if life is going smoothly and all plain sailing, while we were out of relationship with God and there was this day coming where there would be a judgment, it would actually be pretty disastrous if life was so easy until the day we died. Often things like this wake us up to the fact something's wrong, and therefore we need, well, a rescue, help, and that's what Jesus is talking about.
Thank you. Some quite detailed, more specific questions then about what you said earlier and about the passage. So here's the first one. How do we know when enough riches, security is enough? So you said earlier that he wasn't rich enough. How do we know when enough is enough?
Yeah, what is riches towards God? What is enough? I mean, the problem is he has nothing. It's not that he has a little bit of riches. So we're not talking about at all. How can we earn the points? How can we get cash in the bank that when we get to meet God, we've got enough? It just doesn't work like that at all. Basically, she's saying he had nothing. All of us of ourselves have nothing. Let me show you a fabulously wealthy man in Luke's gospel. Turn to Luke chapter 23. We are now right at the end of the historical account, page 76. And the richest man, you'd be surprised to hear, is wearing next to nothing. He's got a battered body. He's hanging on a cross. I'm not talking about Jesus. I'm talking about the man next to him. He was probably a petty thief, probably because he had nothing in the world's terms. But look down now to verse 42 at the bottom of page 76. That man, hanging on the cross next to Jesus, said to him, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." And your view of what Jesus stands for, what he teaches, is really then depends on what you make of what Jesus says there. If Jesus is who he claims to be, if there is a time when our soul will be required and we will meet with God, if we have that promise from Jesus, "Truly I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise," on the day we die, we are fabulously wealthy. Ultimately, our bank accounts here, our assets, whatever we've experienced, just doesn't matter. If Jesus says on that day, "He's with me, he's in. She's with me, she's in." And that also underlines it's about relationship. So these riches are really talking about relationship. It's not material stuff at all. It's, do we know our maker? Do we know Jesus, who claims to be our maker in the flesh? Are we with him? There's nothing we can do about that ourselves, but Jesus came to die so that he could say to people like that man and to us, "He's with me, she's with me," and because we're with him, we have access into paradise, as Jesus calls it, which again is the place where we'll be with him forever, which is the place those who know Jesus most want to be. We'll get everything else chucked in as well, wonderfully, but it'll be with Jesus. That's what riches is, knowing Jesus now and forever. You might be listening and saying, "Well, that doesn't sound great at all. I mean, who cares?" Well, that shows you don't know Jesus. And my encouragement is, come to know Jesus, to know his love, to know what he would do for those who've turned against him. And you may well come to see that actually is riches, for Jesus to say, "He or she is with me."
Thank you. You've just said there are riches in the future. This person asks, "Well, what about the riches that we receive this side of heaven? Can we enjoy the gifts God has given us now?"
Chapter 12, it's where I spoke from those verses. There's lots that could be said in answer to that question, but let's just see some of the words of Jesus. So turn over the page to the a bit further on in chapter 12. Notice after the parable of the rich fool, he says, "Do not be anxious. Don't worry about stuff like that." So what about stuff in this world? Well, I wonder what you make of these words of Jesus. Look down to verse 32. He says, "Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." Like I said, it's a gift, all that you need. So therefore, what now? Jesus says, "Sell your possessions and give to the needy. Provide yourselves with money bags that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." God is a very generous giver. He gives us so much now to enjoy wonderfully. Enjoy it. But thank him for it, as you should, because it's all from him. But I don't know who's asking that question. Is the question saying, but can it be my treasure? Can that be what my life is about now? The money, the career, the status? No, that's very dangerous. If I'm asking that question because I want those things as number one in my life now, that's disastrous. Because that again is saying to God, no thanks. But if our treasure is him and knowing Christ, live for those things, which might mean giving all that stuff away, or it might not. Enjoy it, but not as your treasure in that way.
Thank you. Somebody asks about what Jesus says when he says, "fool." Surely that's too strong.
Well, I hope you're shocked by it. That's the whole point. There is the man we dream of being like. He's got it all. He's got it made. This is it. This is what we, those out there, are busting a gut, giving themselves for. Maybe damaging their families, maybe damaging their health. Everything driving for this. And even if they're not, even if it all looks okay on the outside, Jesus still says, if that's what your life is about, if you are making it, but that's it, you're a fool. That is deeply offensive. I know that. I'm glad I'm not saying that. Jesus is saying that. You're a fool. He's picking up on language in the Old Testament. We won't turn to it now, but it's in the, what's called wisdom literature. What's the wise way to live your life? And ultimately, what is wisdom? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And therefore, if there's no fear of the Lord, if that's completely absent from the way that you live, that's foolish.
Thank you. Some questions pushing deeper on some of the implications of what you said. Does this parable mean I shouldn't try to make money or have other goals in life?
Of course not. You have to live. You have to provide. God made work for us to enjoy. Again, it's worth going back to Genesis even, as well as the rest of the Bible. God made us to enjoy this world, to enjoy its blessings, to work, to earn a living. The Bible says provide for yourself and for others. The Bible actually says one reason you'll want to work is to give to others, as in that would be the real driver, not if you happen to have stuff left over. What a joy to be able to work hard for the good of others who need it. So the Bible has all kinds of motivations, but essentially, yes, we're made to work. So as far as you are able and God gives you the strength to do so, work. And then a goal, well, depends what you mean by goal. Not the overarching top aim in my life. But yes, I want to work so that I can provide and enjoy God's good gifts and help others with it. And then, well, again, what's the aim going to be? We're still in chapter 12. Let's look back one verse. So, again, there is all of this. This is fair enough. None of this is Jesus saying, I'm going to take you out of this world. You just still need jobs, money, food, clothing, all those things. But here's the way to think about it all. So when he says, do not be anxious, then right at the end, verse 31, so just before the verse we looked at, Jesus says, instead, seek his kingdom, and these things will be added to you. So they are fair questions, how do we live the rest of life? But Jesus is saying at the heart of it is the kingdom. If you've realized God is there, revealed himself in Jesus, he's come on this rescue mission to bring us back to God, and yet we're still in this world, what should then be the controlling aim or desire? Well, the kingdom. Living for Jesus as king, pleasing him, making him known to others, and using other resources God might give me to that end. Seek the kingdom, because we've realized the ultimate value of Jesus and his kingdom.
Thank you. And someone else asked a very similar question. They say elsewhere in the Bible it seems to encourage work as a good thing. So do we live to work? Do we work to live? What do we live for?
We live for Christ. We live for Jesus. We live to know that relationship. And when you get Jesus, you get everything else thrown in wonderfully. And so, yes, we are human. We were made in God's image. What does it mean to be human? Well, we don't work enough for ourselves. We look to the Bible, as that is said. And yes, we therefore work. We were made to work in the right way, different roles, as we are able. Then we were made to be productive, to be serving others, to be useful, and to exercise right dominion in this world God has given us. So yes, go for it. Work. Question again?
The question was, so do we live to work? Do we work to live? What do we live
so
for?
So then again, if you live for the last question, you seek the kingdom because you live for Jesus. But then in all these questions, which are great ones, you'll just ask Jesus, and he's told us. So we'll work out how he would have us live, and then we will live that way. And we will enjoy those things in the right way, because they won't be the top of the list, but we'll think, I can enjoy it as a gift of my Father in this good world that he has made.
Someone else asks, perhaps quite honestly, can I spend my money as I want, or do I have to give it away?
You get to give it away. Isn't that wonderful? The world, you can't do that. The world, you must grab onto it and hold onto it, because the world's out of control. You never know when you might need your money, so you've got to hold onto it, basically. You need the insurance policy. If you have a Heavenly Father who you know is in control, who you can trust, even when life is hard, which it will be for Christians, but you know you can trust him, you get to give your money away. You get to use your resources not to grab for you, but to serve others. And that is wonderful. And those of us who are believers need to believe that more and more, that we can trust our Heavenly Father. He'll provide what we need. And in what he then gives us over in abundance, we get to use it for others. And he will even use us to do that, which is a wonderful privilege.
Someone else asked, should I stop work then?
No.
Okay, let's move on. Someone else asks about family, so they're thinking about housing, having a car, that kind of thing. And they say it feels hard to live this kind of way, if that might mean it's difficult to provide for family. So how do we answer that?
Good question. The Bible wants his people, in the Bible, God wants his people to provide for their families. That is a responsible thing to do. But yet, as a family, still, if we know Jesus, as a family, our aim is still first to seek the kingdom. And the Bible might help us with what we need, what Londoners like us think we need for us and our family may not quite fit with what Jesus thinks we need if we are seeking first his kingdom. So yes, of course, provide. None of this is to say we're going to abandon our families at all. But again, individually and as a family, seek the kingdom, work for what you need, and then you get to use anything beyond that God gives you to serve his kingdom.
Thank you. Someone else says, if God has given us physical gifts, what's our responsibility in relation to the parable of the talents, they ask.
Parable of the talents is Luke 19. We can look at it very briefly. We won't go through it all now, but those of us who are studying the Bible in Luke's Gospel week by week are going to get here very soon. But the question, a lot of our questions really have been about this. If Jesus is who he says he is, he's the king. If he's died and risen, where is he now? He's at his father's side. But he hasn't yet taken us to be with him. This is the Bible's now storyline picture. But Jesus says he will come back and bring history to an end when there'll be that final reckoning. What do we do in between? And then Jesus told a story, as we've seen this evening, as he often does to help us understand it. And I'll just begin to read it. As they heard these things, Jesus proceeded to tell a parable because he was near to Jerusalem. They supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. So they thought the minute they got to Jerusalem, that would be it, the end, with a capital E. But Jesus says, no. Verse 12, a nobleman went into a far country to receive himself a kingdom and then return. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 minas and said to them, engage in business until I come. So Jesus is the nobleman of the story. He's gone far country, which means he'll be away some time. And while he has gone, he's giving to his servants, his people, these minas. Sometimes translated talents, what it really just means is money or resources. So it's actually whatever God has given to his people, he is saying, engage in business. And he doesn't just mean make money, because what is the business of the king? That is Jesus, the nobleman. Well, we've seen the spread of his kingdom, seek the kingdom. So therefore, whatever gifts or abilities God has given you, thank him for them. But then the aim is not then to boost my own greatness. It's to think, well, with what God has given me, how can I use them to advance the interests of Jesus until he comes back? Again, that'll only make any sense to you if you believe Jesus rose again. He is coming back. You know him already, so you know you're safe. There's a future for you with Jesus. You are now freed to give your time now in his service.
Thank you. We're almost there. Just here's one more question. How does Jesus' death fit in with all of this? So you mentioned Jesus' death. Someone asked, what's the relevance of that?
So we, this evening, have been looking at Luke chapter 12, and then a question by the end of that passage was, what does it mean to be rich towards God? And I gave a very summary answer, but as you would read on, you'd think, well, can I get these riches? What do I have to do? How can I get them? And then you realise more and more as you go through, well, I can't get them. They're beyond me. I'm poor. I'm in massive debt before God. There's nothing I can do. And you read it and you begin to despair. You think, well, Jesus is right, but that's bad, bad news for me. What am I going to do about it? But all of this is happening on a journey to Jerusalem. And the whole point is, you're meant to think, well, what is Jesus going to do in Jerusalem? And he tells us, if you're sitting in Luke chapter 19, page 62 at the top there, why is Jesus on the way to Jerusalem? Verse 10, Jesus says, for the Son of Man, that's a description of himself, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. That's why Jesus came. That sums it up. If Jesus is who he claims he is, the question is, why would he come into our world, into a world that hates him? And then he teaches us that we can do nothing about it. We're lost. And then Jesus says, well, I came to seek you. I came to look for you, came to find you. But as we've heard, that's not enough, because he finds us in rebellion against God. We've run up this massive debt. We deserve God's judgment. There's nothing we can do. But then Jesus says that he came to seek and to save the lost. So it was a search and a rescue mission. And if you've been reading these chapters in Luke, you realize, because all the way along to Jerusalem, he keeps dropping in what's going to happen when he gets there. You could turn back a page. Chapter 18, it's page 60 at the bottom there. Taking the 12, he said to them, see, we are going up to Jerusalem. Everything that is written about the Son of Man and by the prophets will be accomplished. He'll be delivered over the Gentiles, be mocked, shamefully treated, and spat upon. And they will kill him. So he's saying, really, the only way you can understand Jesus is understanding he's going to Jerusalem to die. And the reason he is there to die is to pay that debt that we owe to God. So he's taking the punishment that we deserve on that cross. Remember when the other man said, remember when you come into your kingdom. Jesus says, you will be with me in paradise. Why will that thief who deserves to be punished by God be in paradise? Because Jesus was taking his punishment instead. So Jesus came to die the death we should have died so that we can live the life that he then rose to enjoy and to share with us. Jesus came to seek and to save the lost. That's why he died.
Great. One last question. So just in terms of summing up, three people ask, what does it mean to be rich towards God?
Today you'll be with me in paradise. If you think that is true, that on the day that you and I die, whenever that is, that we will be someone who knows Jesus, that he will say about us, he's with me, she's mine. That is true riches. Nothing else will count, really, on the last day. We'll meet Jesus face to face. And the issue then is, will we know him? If, like the rich man, we've carried on to ignore him, there'll be no relationship, and Jesus will take everything away, and we'll be judged. There'll be no good thing to enjoy at all. But imagine getting there. I know him. I'm with him. Knowing that he has paid the entrance price, if you want to put it that way. I'm in, because he's paid the price. There's nothing left to pay. It's all been done. I mean, that is fabulously wealthy. That is what money can't buy. Whatever you achieve in this life, and in a sense, all the best. Hope you get it all. It'll count for nothing on that day unless Jesus says, he or she is with me.
Thank you, Renee. And do go and grab a seat. Well, that concludes the formal part of our evening, but there are three ways that you might want to take some of these things further, consider it further. The first is you might want to speak to a friend around your table that maybe invited you. The second is do take away these copies of Luke's Gospel as a gift from us and read it for yourself, or if you'd like to read it with someone else. If you're interested in that, a guided read-through with someone else, then do let us know. And finally, please do join us at, not in this building, but at St. Helens, Bishopsgate by the Gherkin at 4 p.m. on Sundays. We're there every week, and we'd love to see you again. Well, some of you may have supper plans as you head on out, but don't feel you have to dash off if you don't need to. There's no need to rush. Feel free to stay around. The building's going to be open for a while yet. And thank you very much for coming.